Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Now we'll speak directly with Robert Howarth about his work and the startling conclusion that methane may contribute almost half of all human-made greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. How do we know? And what can we do about it? Let's find out.
Because it's hard to contain all the methane release. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong, it leads to climate change too.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, here with Robert W. Howarth, the David R. Atkinson Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell University. Dr. Howarth, along with the engineering professor Tony Ingrafia and René Santoro, a research technician, analyzed data from published sources, industry reports, and presentations by the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. It was all to calculate the total greenhouse emissions from hydraulic fracturing of shale gas. Many know it as gas fracking. Their peer-reviewed paper was published in May 2011 in the journal Climatic Change Letters. Bob Howarth, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Bob, you've taken a lot of heat for this paper. Did you expect this much pushback, and have you found some support as well?
We've been surprised by the level of pushback, to be honest. In the 6 months since our paper was published, there have been an incredible amount of attacks on the blogosphere, but there have also been several new peer-reviewed papers and some reports that have come out since then. A few of those reports, two or three of them, support our findings, and others are critical of our findings. But we're pretty confident in what we've said, and so far I've seen nothing to really make me change my mind.
You answered critics in a November speech in Washington, D.C. at the American Association for the Study of Peak Oil, known as ASPO. And if you'll permit an amateur observation from me, my take is this. Some people didn't want you to write about fracking emissions at all. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's an astute observation. You know, the industry and to some extent government as well have been promoting this shale gas as an energy panacea. So, win-win of almost infinite fossil fuels that we can use without really kicking our fossil fuel addiction and yet emit fewer greenhouse gases. Now, the science basis for that assumption that shale gas had a low greenhouse gas footprint just was not there. Our study was the very, very first analysis in the scientific literature, and we reached an opposite conclusion. So apparently a lot of people just prefer to base policy on assumptions as opposed to good data, and they're not happy with what we pulled together.
I was surprised to learn the industry routinely vents methane, a potent greenhouse gas, into the air as part of their normal course of business. Why don't they capture this gas and sell it instead?
Well, that's a good question. Some of the venting they do is simply when they develop a new well, they don't have a pipeline available to connect the new source and get it to market, or if they're developing gas that's associated with oil, it may just not be as valuable as the oil in many cases, and so they'll vent the gas. But there's also, even when they have a pipeline available, they appear to be venting a huge amount of gas. At the time of well completion from one of these shale gas wells, after that frac fluid starts to come back up, there's about a two-week period, and the best evidence is that they're venting large amounts of methane at that point in time. They could collect it and send it to market. They could also flare it, that is, burn it, which would be better from a greenhouse gas standpoint. But the U.S. EPA, who's looked closely at this, estimates that 85% of the time they're neither flaring nor putting it to market. They are simply venting it to the atmosphere. As to why they're not marketing it instead, the EPA estimates that actually if they were to put the equipment in place to capture that initial gas and take it to market, they would turn a profit, but it's a small profit, a very small profit, and the rate of return just is not as up to what the gas industry is used to. So they prefer to use their capital to develop new wells faster instead and simply vent off the gas.
Bob, in your speech at ASPO, you explained a key chart which our radio listeners aren't able to see, of course. Can you give us the highlights from that series of bars in a chart titled Comparison of Greenhouse Gas Emissions from Shale Gas with Low and High Estimates of Fugitive Methane Emissions?
What that shows, we've analyzed the greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas at two time frames, a shorter time frame over a a couple of decades following gas emission and a longer one at a 100-year time frame after emission. And particularly at the shorter time frame, methane is a very large component of the greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas or natural gas in general. Natural gas is mostly methane, and methane is such an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas that you really need to consider its role and not just the carbon dioxide that's burned and released at the time of burning the fuel. So at the shorter time frame, a 20-year integrated time frame after methane's emitted to the atmosphere, the radiative forcing of methane is more than 100 times greater than that of carbon dioxide. And that means that at that shorter time frame, the largest single component of the greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas is the methane leakage and the methane venting. Now, there's some methane venting from coal as well and from oil, but it's a much smaller component of those. And so when we include the methane as part of the greenhouse gas analysis, we conclude, particularly at this shorter time frame, that shale gas actually has the largest greenhouse gas footprint of any fossil fuel out there, far larger than oil, larger than conventional natural gas, and larger than coal as well.
You mentioned Dr. Drew Schindel's new work. Can you tell us who Schindel is and what he is saying that has an impact on this subject?
We used Schindel's work heavily in our analysis. Schindel and colleagues published a paper in the Journal of Science back in 2009 where they reassessed what we call the global warming potential of methane relative to carbon dioxide. Prior to that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, had been saying that at the 100-year time frame, methane was about 72-fold more powerful of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Schindel looked at how methane interacts with other radiatively active materials in the atmosphere and concluded that it's more potent in its influence on global warming relative to carbon dioxide, specifically about 105-fold more. That study has held up very well to scrutiny. Schindel and his colleagues are at the NASA Goddard Space Institute, and in fact, Schindel is the lead author on this whole topic of global warming potentials for the next go-around of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So we use their analysis. We've been criticized for that. Some people say you should use the older, lower numbers. In fact, the U.S. EPA continues to use 15-year-old numbers, which are a good deal smaller. But we think you should use the best, most recent science.
Well, speaking of scientists at NASA, Dr. James Hansen also wrote an important paper on methane in October 2006, and I just want to make a note to listeners. You can find my review of that in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info for this week. I've got a methane primer and kind of a review of what James Hansen said at the time. Why is that James Hansen paper important?
Well, it's a very important paper that Hansen and colleagues wrote. They pointed out that if you don't control methane, the Earth is really in some trouble. And there's another analysis the United Nations just came out with this summer, which really builds on that and puts some newer numbers on it as well. If you look at the Hansen paper and the United Nations report together, what they tell you is that if we do not control methane and only try to control carbon dioxide emissions, we could reach a dangerous tipping point in the climate system as soon as 15 years from now, more likely 30 years from now, but relatively near term. That tipping point might be something like a melting of the permafrost in the Arctic regions, which would put natural sources of methane into the atmosphere and result in sort of a positive runaway global warming. So Hansen did a very compelling job of laying out the basis for that. He said the critical tipping point is 1.8 degrees above the historical baseline for global mean temperature. And what the United Nations shows is that we're very likely to reach that tipping point without immediate effort to control methane. That's part of the reason I think shale gas is such a poor energy bridge. It's likely to aggravate the methane releases as opposed to controlling them.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Robert Howarth from Cornell University. He upset the golden goose of shale gas fracking, saying, as you've just heard, it's not a solution to avert climate change. Specific to the shale gas industry, Bob, what research do we need? What do we need to know more about?
Well, there's several aspects we should be paying closer attention to. You know, our paper, which came out last April, use the best available data on what the methane emissions, both venting and leakage, are. But as we said in the paper, the quality of the data and the documentation behind the data are in many cases poor. So we need better information on what those fluxes are. We need a better sense of how much those might be able to be reduced. Unfortunately, industry has taken sort of a head-in-the-sand approach to this. So the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has, in fact, proposed regulations which would require industry to provide better data on what the emissions are, and the American Natural Gas Association and Chesapeake Gas Corp, which is the largest developer of shale gas, have gone to court to try to prevent them being compelled to provide that information. So having industry comply with reporting requirements would be extremely helpful. Beyond that, we really need some independent verification of these numbers. And I don't think society wants to be in the position of relying just on industry for the source of such important information.
Bob Howarth, some of your critics complain that you, a mere professor of ecology and biology at Cornell University, dare to examine emissions from this bonanza of shale gas fracking. Yet before your paper in Climatic Change Letters, neither the government nor the industry was undertaking a comprehensive review of the problem. Bob, if they don't want you to do the studies, who should do it?
There's an aspect of the industry that just doesn't want information out there, and I'm afraid that pertains to government as well. This win-win thought that shale gas would allow an easy way forward with energy policy without having to make hard choices on things like conservation and using energy more efficiently is just too attractive for some politicians. So I think they just really don't want objective information. I mean, it's comparable to what our society and government has done in developing ethanol from corn, which all of the best science information would suggest probably aggravates global warming as opposed to helps it. And we now use some 40% of the corn of the United States to produce ethanol, producing pretty small amounts of energy, less than 1% of our total energy use in the United States, and yet a massive disruption to the global food markets.
Is there a standard measurement of methane in the global atmosphere like the Mauna Loa reports on carbon dioxide? And if so, are the gross amounts of methane on the rise?
Yes, the average methane in the atmosphere back when I was a graduate student in the 1970s was about 1.4 parts per million. That's been rising pretty steadily from the 1970s up until late 1990s. And in the 1990s, it actually leveled off and it didn't go down, but the concentration was steady for a number of years, which gave some hope that perhaps we'd gotten things under control. In retrospect, that seems to have been associated with the collapse of the natural gas industry in the former Soviet Union. And over the last half dozen years or so, again, the methane concentrations are once more on the rise. Exactly what's driving that is not as well known as it should be. There are a lot of sources of methane to the atmosphere, both natural and human controlled, and a lot of sinks for methane as well. And we have an imperfect understanding of how those all fit together.
At the end of your speech at ASPO USA in Washington, D.C., you suggested methane could account for as much as 44% of the entire greenhouse gas emissions of the United States. Now, you were hurried due to time limitations. Could you expand on that?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to expand on that. The EPA, within the last year, and particularly last spring, about the same time as our paper came out, has started to reanalyze the greenhouse gas inventory for the entire United States, all sources of greenhouse gas emissions. And in doing so, they've increased their estimate for how much methane is coming from the natural gas industry. They now say it's close to 40% or so of all of the human-controlled methane emissions are coming from natural gas. A fair amount of that is coming from shale gas in their estimation. They still underestimate the importance of methane, though, because they're using this global warming potential, the comparison of methane to carbon dioxide. They're using a value that came out of the early 1990s. It's low. It's about 21-fold larger for methane than for carbon dioxide. It's based on the 100-year time frame, and it's a low number even for that time frame. If you were to instead take the 20-year time frame and use the latest information from Schindel and colleagues on what the global warming potential for methane is, then you'd scale up their methane compared to carbon dioxide, and that's how I reached the conclusion that it would be about 45% of the total greenhouse gas emissions for the entire United States are coming from this methane. And again, the natural gas industry would be the major part of that.
Dr. Howarth, surely you must have thought about the big picture impacts of your paper. Millions of us heat with gas, millions more drive with it, whole industries count on it. If gas is little better than coal, what should we do about all the proposed new drilling, not just in the United States, but it's happening in Canada and the UK and all over the world? What do we do now?
Well, my take is that we should put a moratorium on this at least until we have a better understanding of the environmental consequences, both the global warming consequences and the water quality aspects, which I think are also quite severe. Are there alternatives to simply developing more of this natural gas? And absolutely. You know, most of the natural gas, both globally and in the United States, is used for heating. It's used to heat water. It's used to heat space in homes and commercial buildings. And there's the lowest hanging fruit for energy policy is, you know, better insulating homes, using energy for heating more efficiently. We just, as a society, don't pay enough attention to how easy it would be to use less energy for heating. So I think if we moved aggressively towards energy conservation, particularly in the home heating market, that we could more than offset the natural gas we might get from shale, and it would be at far better consequences for the environment, and probably create more jobs as well.
What made you look into the full impact of gas fracking?
I actually knew very little about hydraulic fracturing until just a couple of years ago. I was on sabbatical leave at the University of Paris back in the spring of 2009 and started to hear rumors about an expanded hydraulic fracturing for gas. It's a new technology. You know, it's been used in Texas for the last 10, 12 years. Outside of Texas, significant shale gas development has occurred only in the last 3 to 4 years, so it's a new technology. I came back from sabbatical. There was a proposal to increase shale gas development in New York State, and Pennsylvania started to have some development. And it was being widely advertised on TV as this energy future that's good for global warming. That just didn't ring true. I, for the previous few years, had been chair of the International Council of Sciences Committee on Biofuels and the Environment. We'd looked very carefully at the greenhouse gas footprint associated with biofuels. And, you know, I knew there's a lot of complexity there, which perhaps wasn't reflected in the advertisements. So I looked into the, I looked forward, let me phrase it that way, the scientific literature which would deal with the greenhouse gas emissions from shale, and I found there's absolutely nothing there. So with some courage, we decided to step into the vacuum and take it on as a research challenge. And we spent about 2 years searching for information and running draft ideas by colleagues and by expert critics, and that finally culminated in that paper last April.
Bob Howarth, what is next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, we're doing a few things. I mean, at the moment, we're writing a summary of all of the papers and reports that have come out since our paper 6 months ago. Beyond that, we're looking more carefully at the global trends in methane and what the role of the oil and gas industry may be in those. We're looking more directly at the greenhouse gas inventory for the United States and how that might be able to be reduced through alternative energy policies.
You have been listening to Robert Howarth, the Cornell University scientist who investigated the real story of dangerous methane emissions from the shale gas industry. Find links to his work, his speech at ASPO, and an MP3 of this interview in the Radio EcoShock blog dated November 23, 2011, at ecoshock.info. Bob, thank you so much for starting this whole conversation.
Thank you for your interest. I'm very pleased to be able to talk with you today.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Carbon trading schemes have been the darlings of governments, banks, and Wall Street traders. They say, let the free market solve climate change. But the system has been abused in many ways. Here is my conversation with famed biologist Samuel Labate of the International Investigation Agency. Production of the world's most powerful global warming gas is being ramped up to collect fake carbon credits, say environmental investigators. As the World Bank has handed out billions of dollars to suspect companies in China and India, we go to Samuel Labate, a famous wildlife biologist in Washington, D.C., now covering the atmosphere beat for the Environmental Investigation Agency. Samuel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Sam, I'd like to make the most of our limited time. Please explain what HFC-23 is and the risks to our atmosphere.
Well, HFCs are also known as hydrofluorocarbons, and that doesn't mean much except that they're one of the six greenhouse gases, along with CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and a couple others. HFCs are the replacement compounds for the chemicals that formerly were destroying the ozone, that are still destroying the ozone layer. The things in our refrigerators and air conditioners used in foam blowing, applications like that. And you wouldn't think that our collected refrigerators and air conditioners could have such a huge impact on climate, but bear in mind that our refrigerators and air conditioners were what punched a continent-sized hole in the ozone layer that we're still working very hard to try and repair. So these hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, they're the replacements for ozone-depleted chemicals. And they are, even though they're compared to other greenhouse gases, there really is no comparison. They are what we call super greenhouse gases. They have an ability to trap light energy and convert it to heat, like CO2 does, except they are hundreds to thousands of times more powerful than CO2 as warming agents. And so they're a big problem.
Do they also damage the ozone layer?
They do not. That's why they were chosen as substitutes for the compounds containing chlorine, which do attack and destroy ozone. And among these HFCs, HFC-23 is the most powerful one. In fact, it is the second most powerful greenhouse gas known to science. It's 15,000 times more powerful than CO2 as a warming agent. The odd thing about HFC-23, however, is it's not even produced intentionally for any use. It's a byproduct of a ozone-depleting substance that's still being manufactured largely in overseas and developing countries that haven't quite caught up to the Western world, per se, in terms of phasing out their ozone-depleting substances. A lot of it's just vented directly into the atmosphere, where it plays havoc with climate.
So if I understand this correctly, about half of the carbon credits to date are allegedly to prevent the production of a gas, which could easily and cheaply have been solved years ago. Is that correct?
The HFC-23 is a waste gas. It's a byproduct of a production of an ozone-depleting substance that's supposed to be being phased out under the Montreal Protocol. The problem is that in the international world of carbon credits, or offsets as they're called, the United Nations and the Kyoto Protocol are actually paying developing countries to capture and destroy this waste gas in the routine manufacture of the refrigeration compound that they're still manufacturing. The problem is they pay them so much for the destruction of this waste gas that oftentimes the carbon credits that they get from capturing and destroying it are worth more than their principal product that they're producing. So this has created what we call a perverse incentive. Because countries like China and India are receiving so much money to destroy this byproduct, this waste gas, they actually intentionally produce more of it so they can get paid more. So basically a lot of the carbon credits that have been issued under the Kyoto Protocol, estimates are as much as a quarter to a third of all the carbon offsets ever issued under Kyoto, are basically frauds. They didn't offset anything, in spite of the fact that they cost about $2 billion to buy. And these offsets are supposed to be the world's first line of defense against global warming. This is how we're supposed to be encouraging developing countries and stimulating countries in the European Union and Japan and other Kyoto signatories to limit their own emissions so that they don't have to buy these offsets.
Well, just recently, the Environmental Investigation Agency suggested China may be engaged in a kind of global warming blackmail. Can you tell us about that?
This waste gas, all the facilities that manufacture or that produce this HFC-23 waste gas in Europe, Japan, the United States, voluntarily capture and destroy the HFC-23 as part of the cost of doing business, as part of responsible industry practice, if you will. And developing countries, because Kyoto has paid them so much to destroy this waste gas, they basically created an industry for producing this. And recently, the European Union, the 27 nations over there, decided that these credits were not good. They weren't good for carbon markets. They weren't doing a lot to slow down or reverse global warming. And they passed legislation where they're going to basically ban the use of these credits in their carbon market beginning in 2013. And that is the world's biggest carbon market. And China has decided that, or is threatening that if they're not going to be paid to capture and destroy this waste gas and eliminate its powerful impact on global warming, that they're simply going to vent it into the atmosphere. This despite the fact that China alone has been paid somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion to capture and destroy this waste gas, enough money to basically pay for the destruction of this waste gas for decades to come, well past the time at which it's supposed to be phased out completely. And so this basically amounts to blackmail. They're saying, if you won't pay us ridiculous, absurd amounts of money to destroy something that we should be destroying anyway, just of our own accord, then we're going to bin it into the atmosphere, and the world will have hell to pay for it.
Yeah, and it lasts 250 years. Well, Samuel Labuddy, we've known about this loophole for years, but at the end of 2011, we're still going to the Durban Climate Conference trying to seal it up. What needs to happen there?
A lot of things need to happen in Durban. With respect to this particular issue, I think some of the parties need to make it clear, basically the Kyoto signatories that pay for carbon offsets, that they need to tell the Chinese and the Indian governments very clearly that these credits have no place in the future of carbon markets, and that when the current contracts expire for HFC 23 destruction, that that's it. At that point, China and India and everybody else that's manufacturing or that's generating this waste gas, they need to take responsibility for the costs of capturing it and destroying it themselves. The nations of the world need to let China and India know that this gravy train, if you will, that has basically subsidized an industry that's supposed to be being phased out, is done. One thing they cannot do is indulge this type of greed going forward if we're actually going to be responsive to addressing climate change.
Do they need to pass a new law? Do they have to just come up with a signed agreement with the countries? What actually will be the mechanism that ends this whole facade?
That's a good question. There are a number of problems with the offset market. This is clearly the largest one. More so than an agreement being signed, I think it's just a matter of a political reality becoming clear so that the governments like China and India can become more realistic about what they can expect in the future going forward and what they have to contribute to a global climate agreement if indeed we are going to be effective in combating global warming.
Well, I would say if we're going to survive. Can you please give us your organization website for those who want to follow up?
Yes. In the United States, it's eia-global.org. I mean, we have a number of reports about our different campaigns, not just on climate and atmosphere, but also on illegal wildlife trade and illegal logging as well.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the award-winning scientist Samuel Labuddy from the Environmental Investigation Agency. Thank you for helping us out today.
Thank you.
During this program, you heard clips from the song My Water's on Fire Tonight, written and performed by David Holmes, Andrew Bean, and Neil Becker. That's from the Australian anti-fracking album, Whole Lot of Fracking Going On, at wholelotoffrackinggoingon.com. The song is based on ProPublica's investigation on hydraulic fractured gas drilling. Find links to their whole investigative report and to the song video in my Radio EcoShock blog for November 23rd, 2011, at ecoshock.info. That's E-C-O, shock, like an electric shock, .info. You can download today's program and all of our past programs at our website, ecoshock.org. I am Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
What the fuck is going on?